Ashley Slater is here at Jazz FM. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's great to be here.
It's been a bit of a year for you in many respects.
It's been a little bit silly.
As a musician, you've on two fronts, you've attacked the music. You've reformed Loose Tubes and come back with new material on one side. Of course, that legendary English eccentric big band that you were a part of, which kind of forged the new sound of jazz in the late 80s. And on the other hand, we've recently seen you on mainstream TV. Let's start with Loose Tubes.
Sure.
It was a triumphant comeback for you and the mighty Loose Tubes. How many in the band these days? 21, 22?
21, yeah.
21.
Yeah.
At the Cheltenham Jazz Festival. Did you enjoy that?
Absolutely loved it, of course. Yeah, it was fabulous. And, I mean, you know, the music was great. Goes without saying. It was great to revisit that stuff and also great to play some new stuff and hear the band kind of attacking it with a bit more experience. You know, it took a bit less time to get things together this time around, which was really nice. I enjoyed that. So, yeah, and then Cheltenham was actually a bit of a blur. I can remember a lot more about Ronnie's than Cheltenham because Cheltenham was just nerves, you know.
I was going to say, you did appear, you guys, to be nervous, but after about 10 minutes, the old magic just kicked back in.
Sure, yeah. Well, I get nervous for other reasons in that, you know, I have to do the... I don't have to, but I ended up doing a lot of the announcements in between things, and I didn't want to say anything too wrong, basically. So that's kind of an added pressure.
You know, we're all sitting there waiting for you to come out with something controversial.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Does that help with your, you know, the overall feeling and settling the nerves with you there sort of bantering and saying, because you were making all sorts of jokes about, you know, people who would have seen you are dead now and stuff, just being very frank about it. I mean, it was 21 odd years, was it? Or yeah, 21 years, wasn't it? 20 odd years before.
I guess if you... I guess that last Ronnie's week was at 89, wasn't it? So,
right.
Yeah, it's 24 years.
24 years. Amazing.
If not longer.
Yeah,
that is... I mean, because if we do it again, certainly some of us will be dead if we have to wait that long to do another reunion. Plus, I wouldn't even want to go see that.
But I think you on the mic just introducing the songs and bantering with Django and the rest of the guys is an integral part of that whole vibe of Loose Tubes, isn't it? Slightly humorous.
I think so. I mean, I know back in the day, you know, sometimes I would say something that would offend a member of the band and there'd be a big, you know, big Loose Tubes style. We, the band, demand that other people are allowed to speak in between tunes and all that. And then they would do it for a while and then it wasn't funny and not amusing and not very good, really. And then I would just get the chair back. So... It was funny this time, and when Django got in touch, I said, you do realize it's in my contract that I have to do the interstitials, as we now call them, and had great fun with that. I think out of the whole that Cheltenham and the week at Ronnie's and somewhere in Wales, Brecon, that was it, yeah. I only made one announcement that annoyed anyone, so I'm quite pleased with that. It's not a bad record.
The week at Ronnie's was tremendous, wasn't it? I mean, that really was the old fire stoked up there. I was there. You could barely fit the band in, as usual. Mm. I think you were up in the cheap seats at the sides and all over the place.
Mm. It was brilliant. And I think it was something of a kind of a return to our spiritual home. Although, why we, this allegedly iconoclastic kind of big group of the 80s, would see the establishment venue of Ronnie Scott's as our spiritual home is still a bit of a mystery to me, but it was, it was absolutely brilliant. I wish we could do it twice a year. It would be something really to just kind of keep, it's something to feed off, you know, and it informs my other music, always has done, you know, that you can't work with guys like Django and Steve Perry and Eddie Parker, all those guys play all that music without having some kind of effect on your own music. So, yeah, I kind of expected to hear more development in playing on the soloing side. I mean, I think I've developed as a soloist in that I'm not having to play bass trombone anymore, which is essentially a Hoover. And it's quite difficult to get a good solo out of a Hoover, although Richard Henry does a good job. I always found it really frustrating trying to solo on that thing. So it was great to be back on tenor trombone and just be able to wail, you know, to my heart's content, which I did. I think I killed several whales on that week at Ronnie's.
And we, of course, you've had some amazing success on the in-between of what you're doing now and the, you know, the closure of the Loose Tubes chapter earlier on, because you were with Norman Cook with Freak Power. That must have been some fun. Pop hits.
Well, it's funny, actually. I mean, there are a lot of things that come flooding into my head when you say that, but for me, one of the nicest things is that I was able to go away and do that, and I'm still kind of quite welcome in the jazz community. I thought I would be a pariah, an outcast, exactly, you know, sell out and all that stuff. But I've only ever really been one thing, and that's kind of a manic front guy. You know what I mean? Even with Loose Tubes. So, you know, then I went off to do this band Microgroove. I did gigs with you and Jez Nelson back in the day, playing horn riffs over records that you guys had slowed down just enough to make it a bit uncomfortable. Of course, we don't get that anymore with digital technology. And, you know, Microgroove led to Freak Power. Norman and his management company had seen the band a few times. And in fact, Norman rang me up one day when I didn't know him very well, and he was still quite a big name even then. He said, "Yeah, it's Norman. I'm just lying in the bath listening to you. It sounds like the Blues Brothers meets the JBs, probably. That's the most likely one." So then, you know, we formed this thing called Freak Power. He had an album half written, which was going to be a Beats International album, but he just had got tired of that sound. It was quite white, you know, and I think, and even though I am obviously fairly white myself, so it was a chance for Norman to kind of go ethnic without getting too real. That's a terrible thing to say.
Interesting story. But you yourself, you came from California over to the UK many years ago, right? That's from correct. From San Francisco?
Well, near there. I mean, I have to say San Francisco because people who don't live in America, only being people who do live in America, think that California has basically two cities. One is Los Angeles and one's San Francisco, and then there's nothing else. But the place is 1,000 miles long, you know, it's crazy. So if you were to go to San Francisco and drive north for 8 hours, you would come to my house, which was in a mountain village, population 300. So there was obviously not much future as a trombone player. And we used to go down there, like you guys from London, you go to the country to relax, and we used to get in the car and go to the city, you know, for a bit of people walking around, but more than two of them at a time. You know, it was quite fun and quite bustling. So, yeah, that was, I mean, it is a kind of a spiritual home for me. And I think if I had, you know, I would like to go back there and live there, but on the other hand, I don't think I would, because there's a lot of crazy people, angry people with guns, which is never an attractive living scenario for me.
No,
because people get angry at me, and I don't need people getting angry at me who own guns.
Let's cut through to recent events. There was a bit of a fervor on Twitter and on Facebook. People, fellow musicians and contemporaries, going, "My God, I've just seen my old mate Ashley Slater on X Factor," and it was a bit of a surprise. Although you did announce that you were going to be on there, but that whole process for you, how was it? Because yourself and Scarlett as the band Kitten and the Hip have already been going a little while and had some pretty useful success as well, right?
We're doing okay with that band, yeah, but of course, basically the opportunity arose for us to take part in the X Factor process. And, I mean, I'm going to be frank, I loathe the show. I don't loathe it for any other reason than I don't really like this ITV light entertainment approach to comedy, which is just to be horrible to people and make them look stupid and feel awful. I don't, even though I'm brilliant at doing that myself, I don't like watching it on TV. You know, it's all right to do in your living room with a few mates, but I find it uncomfortable viewing. You know, you might have people there with obvious, you know, mental issues and stuff like that, really being laughed at, and I don't enjoy it, you know. But the competition side and all that kind of stuff, that's kind of interesting. And of course, Scarlett and I work as top liners, and we write, you know, tunes for DJs and all that kind of stuff anyway. So it's always good to watch, to kind of see what's happening from a current kind of musical standpoint, what kind of voices are in the fashion, what kind of songs go down well, all that kind of stuff. So we do watch it every year, but I am inevitably tweeting, you know, awful things about just probably exactly what I've said I don't like watching on TV. But we went there, and it is a friend of mine who has worked on the show said, Ash, it's not a talent competition, it's a TV show. Just get your head around that. And it is. I mean, you're a piece of meat that gets moved around from point A to point B without really being looked after in any way. It's fairly brutal. And the process itself is brutal. And, you know, I personally had a very positive approach to the whole thing. I thought, let's go in there and win it. That was all I thought. I didn't have any cynical thoughts. I didn't have any negative thoughts at all. I just, you know, Scarlett and I have been working on this project for 3 years. The chance came. I thought, yeah, let's go and do what we can do. So we had the producers' auditions singing this song called Shut Up and Dance, which they had found on the internet and just fallen in love with it. And it's really a very, very simple tune. There's actually only one verse in it repeated 3 times. It's not my best work, let's put it that way. Certainly not in my head.
It's classic dance music,
though. Well, yeah, in that sense, you're right. Yeah, and there have been some brilliant dance mixes of it as well, and it works very well as that kind of record. So, you know, we went up there, got in the room, and as soon as we got in the room, it was pretty ugly what happened. I mean, you know, you can see it on the internet, on YouTube and everything, but some of the stuff that was said was really personal, and other judges are going, really? I don't think you should have said that. I mean, I'm not going to name any names here, but it was, you know, toe-curlingly, like, yeah. Just oof. Yeah, well, pardon me, I can't say that. I just wanted the ground to open up at many points during that 20-minute room audition.
It did look to me that perhaps the edit was a little brutal, you know, kind of setting it up as, because it was very ageist, you know, the thing that stood out from it was their surprise at the difference between you and Scarlett's age. Like, so what?
Well, you know, the thing is, we have got used to that now because we've been together for 4 years. And don't really think twice about it. But, you know, it was a reality check, and that not everybody in the world thinks it's cool. And a lot of people think I'm some creepy old dude, you know, who's gone out and somehow snared this, you know, attractive, incredibly talented, very beautiful, and really quite... She is a catch, you know, at the end of the day. But actually, she came after me. And we were being very professional for quite a long time. We were writing together and everything. And then, you know, she mentioned to my partner that she found me attractive. And I was single on my own. I thought, well, gee, I don't know. She's awfully young. You know, I had my reservations. But in truth, we get along. I mean, I can say that this is the best relationship I have ever had with another human being. And I'm very happy with it. You know, I've got no complaints at all. Plus, she's great. You know, has a great talent. She's got a great voice. She's got great ears. She's a good writer. You know, there's a lot in that partnership for me and for her. We are very happy as a couple.
Yeah, that's so, sorely lost on light entertainment TV, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's fair enough. And like I said, it is a reality check. Not everyone in the world thinks that love conquers all, you know, and not everyone in the world thinks it's cool for some old guy, which I don't really think I'm that old, to have a girlfriend younger than it, much younger than him. But there you go.
I didn't know you were 53. You look good for a 53-year-old,
yes.
Sir.
I think I look damn good. 49.
Even younger. But I know, good luck to you guys. You know, I mean, your family as well with a little one,
yeah.
3-year-old, which is fantastic. So that episode for you is kind of over and done. Has it affected you in a positive kind of way? Are people more interested in you or less interested? Or are they, have your gigs suffered or have you got more gigs? How's it worked?
You know, Chris, it's still difficult to analyze it all. Although I would say that there's definitely... I mean, you know, our likes have gone up, our views have gone up, all that kind of stuff has gone up. Yes, gigs are coming in. And I would say for every 100 messages of support and, yeah, guys, go, there's one negative thing, you know. So as far as I'm concerned, it's a win. And, you know, we also have a long-term plan with Scarlett, and that's to take her back there next year. And knowing what's involved, kick the jams out and walk home with something good this time.
What level did she get to? Was it the boot camp?
Yeah, boot camp.
Pretending I know what that is, actually.
I don't really know. I, again, I'm not too terribly familiar with the process. And I mean, I have to admit that when I was brutally stabbed in the face by Mel B and Louis Walsh.
Not mentioning any names or anything.
Well, no, but that's okay, because they didn't actually stab me in the face. I'm not saying anything awful here. You know, I think I did feel some relief. Damn right I did. Of course I did. I mean, you know, thinking about it, and of course you have these fantasies in your head, these visions, and me and her singing, you know, I got married in a fever, or whatever the hell it was going to be on our, as if we got further. It did all seem rather improbable, but you never know. You just don't know, do you? So, like I said, I mean, my natural attitude, and Scarlett luckily has the same attitude, and that is, you know, take life in both hands and bite big chunks out of it whenever you're given the opportunity. So
that's a great outlook, sir. Great outlook.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your new music. As I speak to you, you're about to get warmed up for a session at Jazz in the Round. This is all roads leading back to what you do through the bizarre many platforms of media. Now we've got this proper, sometimes avant-garde jazz gig, and you're appearing there doing the middle set, which is usually off the wall, free, avant-garde, improvisational thing. What have you got? What have you
They didn't tell me that. I'm going to play some nice tunes that I wrote. I could stand there and fart around on the trombone for 20 minutes and make a bunch of unpleasant noises and probably even some pleasant ones, but I was ruined as a child by my father, who had a taste in easy listening music, which is why I got into bass trombone. I love that sound, oily, sexy George Roberts, you know, holding the whole bottom of the trombone section together. Dad played me stuff by Cy Zentner, where he had this trombone section that were all playing the tiniest possible trombones, so that it just really basically sounded like your head being torn in half when these guys played. I love that sound. And there are very few people who make it. Gary Valenti, I think, and probably a lot of the Latino guys whose names I don't know. But I just really love that, you know, I mean, the trombone is a comedy instrument, agreed. But it's also, it's the preacher. You know, it's the guy that can stand there and lay it down and tell you what's happening, I think, without too much waffle. And my favorite trombone players are those guys, like Gary, like I've mentioned before, those Latin guys. I don't love... I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear it on any instrument, and I really don't want to hear it on a trombone. I just want a trombone to say, amen, pass the peas, I love you, you know, that kind of thing.
And so, in Latin music, they are the armed front line of salsa and Latin jazz, aren't they, trombones?
Sure. For me, my favorite salsa bands, Cuban bands, any of that kind of stuff, the New York bands, always have many trombones, at least, in their lineup, you know. And this album I'm working on now which is going to actually get a commercial release, which is exciting. How many trombone players get to say that these days?
Not many.
No, if any. But it's really visiting my musical career to date. And there's some kind of, some stuff that I took. I did very few gigs with Dudu Pakwana, who I found absolutely terrifying. You know, obviously I'm kind of used to hearing that kind of music through my exposure from people like Django and all that. And it just kind of, it is around the world in 80 beats, I think Norman once described a record as, you know, it is a little bit like that. But I feel like I've earned the right to go there. And, you know, it's always about melody and melodic soloing and not about showing off. I have no technique whatsoever. I often say I'm not a jazz trombonist. I'm a trombone player who likes jazz, which is a fair assessment. And I think any trombone player who's heard me play would agree with that.
Is it really going to be called Jazz Owes Me a Living? Because that is the best title of an album I've heard in 10 years.
Thank you. It is now. You've just confirmed it for me. It's quite interesting for me going back to this place because in 1979-80, I was at Kneller Hall. I was in the army as a trombone player. And I was based at Twickenham. And I knew a guy called Jay Craig, who I had met in Scotland, who's a baritone player. And he said, oh, I think I can... Why don't you come up to some rehearsals? He'd moved down to London before I did. Come up to some rehearsals at the Cockpit. So I used to cycle up there of a Saturday morning to be told how awful I was by Bill Ashton. And he was right. That was the first place I met Steve Arguelles, who was like 10 or something then, you know. Absolutely playing his ass off on this kit, making the band work, you know. And there were some phenomenal young players and, you know, people who are my peers, I guess, you know, Pete Beachall and just that lot, you know, everybody knows them. They were all there, you know, young guys all playing higher, faster, louder, like you're supposed to do when you're young. And so it's a bit of an event for me tonight to actually go back to really where I started being involved in the British jazz scene in 1979. I didn't even know the place was still there, and I'm not even sure where it is, but I hope I'll get there by the time my set comes. Yeah, so if you're coming along tonight to hear some free avant-garde annoying music, don't bother, because I'm just going to play some great stuff that I've been writing.
That'll do nicely. And when can we anticipate this new album release from you?
Well, quite soon, Chris. I've had to take a couple of months off to deal with X Factor shizzle. It's about 80% written and 70% done and produced. So it'll be out probably in the new year. You know, I don't want to put it out before Christmas because I'll be fighting with, you know, Simon Cowell and Robbie Williams and all that for the number one slot in the album charts. So obviously, leave it till, you know, January, February, give myself a chance, you know.
Put it out for free like you too.
Yeah. It's going to be on everybody's Android device. I'm working on an Amazon deal here.
Well, best of luck with it, and I look forward to hearing it in the new year.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me.